The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, everybody, we're going to begin the speaking component of this app. So, as you know, one of the ideas behind integrated curriculum, besides the opportunity for a really good free lunch once in a while, is to highlight how the various domains of law that you're studying actually interact and intertwine when it comes to real-life issues and cases. And so today, the purpose of our talk today is to use the case study of Korematsu, which you'll encounter in con law soon enough, to use the case study of Korematsu as a prism to illuminate issues in constitutional law, national security law, criminal law, both U.S. and international, rhetoric, and property law. And also in hopes of showing how the past can illuminate issues of the present, both in the national and the international scene. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Professor Dodd, who will give you the context and the case of Korematsu, and then each one of us will speak in turn. Professor Hutchinson will give you the equal protection dimension of Korematsu as a case. Professor Dodd will give you the national security dimension of the case. I will give you the criminal law and the international criminal law, in particular the law of war dimension of the case. And Professor Figley will give you the rhetoric dimension of the case, and Professor Smith will give you the property dimension.
Why is that funny? What did you think I was going to talk about?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so it is perfect timing for both Professor Hutchinson and I, because I think that we're turning to the executive power portion of our casebook. Korematsu is one of the cases that dealt with Japanese internment during World War II. So for those of you who want a refresher for the history, right after the Pearl Harbor attack on December 7th, 1941, the federal government had already completed some spy work. They had compiled lists basically of leaders in the Japanese American community. They began rounding up people right away, I think arresting almost 800 leaders in California just that day, the same day as the Pearl Harbor attack. They continued compiling lists, considering what to do. In February, FDR issued an executive order authorizing relocation and eventual camps to hold Japanese American citizens. He put the relocated areas, including California and most of the West Coast, under the authority of different commanders in the military. John DeWitt was the commander in charge of the West Coast. He devised the plan for relocation, which in the opinion, the dissenting opinion in Korematsu by Owen Roberts, he said these are just euphemisms for concentration camps. That's really what they are. So what they did in May of 1942 is require all Japanese American citizens, without any hearing to determine whether they were actually disloyal or not, to report to assembly centers, which were usually at racetracks or other open fields. Fred Korematsu and his family were called up to an assembly center. He refused to go. His family did go. It was a racetrack. The family stayed in a horse stall with no sewage facilities and, you know, understandably smelly, the horse stall. He decided to stay in San Francisco, not initially because he wanted to fight this and contact the ACLU, which is what eventually happened, but because he was in love. So he stayed in San Francisco. He wanted to escape with his fiance, who was Caucasian. She was not a Japanese American, so she wasn't going to be relocated. He actually contacted a doctor, sort of a quack, and had surgery on his eyes, so he was trying to pass as a Caucasian. That was unsuccessful, and there's a great documentary about his case called Of Civil Rights and Wrongs, and I think eventually he realized that maybe his fiance had something to do with getting him turned in. So that's a sad part of the story. But he was arrested. He was required to report to the assembly center. The ACLU decided to help. He agreed to work on the case with the ACLU. And eventually, he fought and was convicted and was sent to what they called the relocation center, a separate facility that was a more permanent set of structures where they housed these internees for almost 3 years, for the most part. So whole families lived in these camps for the duration of the war. Some of the able-bodied sons were drafted from the camps to serve. So there are a lot of cases that dealt with the draft resistors from the camps because they wanted to have their status as disloyal Japanese Americans contested before they agreed to serve in the military. So there are lots of legal cases kind of swirling around this whole internment controversy. One question that a lot of students have is, were there really disloyal Japanese Americans? What was the basis for the government's decision to do this? And John DeWitt, who was the military commander in charge of the West Coast, filed a report in 1942 justifying what they did. It was a second final version of this report. Later, in the 1980s, they discovered in the National Archives the original, where all of the racist language was taken out for the final public report. And what he said in the original report was that it was just too difficult to tell Japanese Americans apart. So it wasn't necessarily military necessity or the time constraints. It was this notion that it was just too hard to distinguish between them or among them. So all of that racist language was never presented to the Supreme Court in these cases. Fred Korematsu was involved in later actions, which I think Damon will talk about, where Japanese American survivors of these camps decided to organize as a movement to seek reparations for the damages that they suffered during the effort. And Fred Korematsu eventually used that expunged report, other material from the National Archives, including a report from J. Edgar Hoover, who, as you all probably know, was the head of the FBI even then. He had said there's no evidence of disloyalty by Japanese Americans in California. And so these different reports that were not presented to the Supreme Court originally in the Korematsu case in 1944 were used to file a writ for coram nobis, which is an extraordinary procedure in situations where you've been convicted of a crime, you've served your sentence, but there's undisclosed evidence, or the prosecutor may have hidden evidence from the federal government, something unusual that justifies having the original conviction overturned. And in a district court in California, a judge granted the coram nobis petition, and Fred Korematsu's original conviction was overturned decades later. So that's just to give you a brief introduction to the case and the history. There's been a lot of other classified material. My fiance actually works in the State Department historian's office, and some of the things that they do is declassify all of this material. There were telegraph intercepts that were under code, and a set from the Japanese espionage ring was called the Magic Intercepts. So there was actually some espionage in California. It's just that they didn't identify any Japanese Americans and actually convict them of anything. So, there's one side that says there was never any disloyal Japanese Americans, and then there is some evidence on the other side to say there was some, but it was something that the government could actually pinpoint. They had the codes. They could break the Japanese intercepts, identify them with some specificity. So the history is a little bit complicated. But why don't we start with the constitutional law issues? And Darren's going to talk a little bit about the court opinions and how they dealt with this notion of guilt by association. Should we actually intern an entire race, just on the grounds of military necessity?
Okay, thank you, Linda. That was a great introduction to the case, and we will be reading that case later in the semester when we get to equal protection. So what I want to do in the piece that I have is to talk a little bit about what this case does for equal protection jurisprudence, meaning it symbolizes the advancement in equal protection jurisprudence by creating a new standard called strict scrutiny. So I'm going to talk about that for a minute. Then I want to go into really what the essence of the equal protection argument was. It was about racial discrimination. So based on a lot of the information that you've already heard and some of the stuff already known and presented to the court at the time, there is an argument, and that was the argument of Korematsu, that the government's internment of Japanese people of Japanese descent was rooted in racial animosity or racial discrimination. So what I want to do is go through some of the arguments around that and place it in a broader historical context. All right, so in terms of equal protection, no state shall deny to any of its citizens equal protection of the law. And that's in the 14th Amendment. It applies to states, but the court has for a long time read into the 5th Amendment of the Constitution an equal protection requirement for the federal government. And so both the national and state governments are bound by notions of equal protection. So this case was presented as an equality claim based on race, and the jurisprudence in race was still young at this point. It really wasn't until the next decade that we get a lot more cases discussing race discrimination, although there were clearly a lot at that time. But this case stands out. It's a landmark decision because it creates this new level of scrutiny called strict scrutiny. And so we've talked a little bit about rational basis in class, and rational basis is, again, this judicial deference. It's a principle of judicial deference, but there are moments in the court's analysis where it's not deferential. So, and one of those moments is where the state action involved in the case or being challenged in the case is rooted in racial discrimination. So instead of being deferential to laws or policies that discriminate on the basis of race, the court applies what Korematsu says is its most rigid scrutiny available. Okay, so strict scrutiny is that highest order of scrutiny. The case hadn't developed the standard as much to the extent that we have today, but in order to survive strict scrutiny, you have to have a compelling interest, and that interest has to be narrowly tailored so as not to unnecessarily discriminate. So in this case, the compelling interest is kind of easy, right? It's national security is a compelling interest, and it's really hard to debate that. So then you can move on to see whether the means taken to pursue national security are narrowly tailored. Is it necessary? And so what courts normally do is they look to see, there are actually two things they may do. They can say, is it over-inclusive? Is this law over-inclusive? They can also see whether it's under-inclusive, and that doesn't go to narrow tailoring. It just lets the court know that there may be some other things going on. All right, so with respect to over-inclusiveness, the national security concern was being pursued in this case by the government by interning all people of Japanese ancestry. So regardless of age, regardless of actual loyalty to the United States, regardless of where they were born, whether they were born in the United States or Japan or elsewhere, they were interned and subject to the executive orders, which is not the type of narrow tailoring that the court has since then validated. Right? So this is the interesting thing about Korematsu. It's the first case to apply strict scrutiny, but it's one of the rare moments where strict scrutiny ended up sustaining the challenged state action. So normally, if strict scrutiny applies, the state action doesn't pass judicial muster, but it did in this case. Moving on to under-inclusivity, there's an argument, and it actually comes up in the dissent, and you know, historians have talked about this, that there were other groups whose home countries or ancestral countries were at war with the United States, and they did not suffer the same type of treatment. So Italian-Americans and German-Americans were not interned throughout the war, and that's a sign that something else was going on, that this was really about discrimination against Asian Americans rather than actual national security concerns. To back that up, and of course the court didn't have access to all of this stuff that we have today, but as Professor Dodd talks about, there's a lot of evidence that's come out later about the fraudulent submission by the government. So the DeWitt Report, and reading that original, it's online, you can actually Google it. The DeWitt Report, the original version, is just an interesting read. And basically says it's impossible to tell the disloyal from the loyal for this particular class, and that's why we have to intern the entire group. And that he also, and actually the Justice Department, the Hoover situation, talks about that the evidence cited in his reports surrounding espionage and sabotage were pretty conclusory statements. So we know that, fill in the blank, without providing much detail about it. And, you know, if you're trying to think about whether something improper is going on versus a proper motivation by the government, certainly falsifying documents, suppressing evidence that goes against your claim, those are things that you would look for if you're sort of litigating a case like this. And the interesting thing, again, is that the conviction was tossed out later in the 80s as some of this information came to light. All right, I don't have too much time left. I just want to go into one other aspect of the case. It's received a lot of attention among people who do race work, either inside of law and also in the humanities and social sciences. The DeWitt argument about the inability to separate the loyal from the disloyal, and meaning whether Japanese individuals were loyal to the U.S. or to Japan, a lot of scholars have, and I think, made a persuasive argument that this follows a stereotype which says that Asian Americans generally are foreign. So when you read the literature, a lot of the scholars in this area say it's a classic line when someone meets an Asian American, where are you from? And then when you say Texas, they say, what are you talking about? So so there's this notion that Asian equals non-citizen, which arguably helped to facilitate the belief that this particular population versus German Americans or Italian Americans were in fact loyal to Japan. And there's a history for that, for excluding Japanese and Asian Americans generally, or Asians generally, from the definition of citizenship. There's a long history of U.S. immigration policy which excluded or set quotas on people coming from Asian countries. The Nationality Act up until the 1950s limited citizenship through the naturalization process to white persons. That was an explicit requirement in the legislation, and that was directed towards Asian people coming from Asian countries as well. So there's a lot there to deal with, and unfortunately I can't go into any more details right now, but certainly as we get to the issue in class and in the Q&A, we can talk about it in greater detail. Thanks.
Okay, so the only other thing that I wanted to talk about in terms of the national security dimension of these cases is when can the federal government put someone into prison during wartime who's a U.S. citizen without satisfying a kind of due process, individualized hearing? And in this case, in the Korematsu case, the court actually limited the question before the court. They said the question before the court was whether Fred Korematsu was required to report to a relocation facility so that he could be excluded from San Francisco or California, really. There was another case, which no one ever talks about for some reason, called Ex Parte Indo. And it was actually heard, the oral arguments were scheduled the same day as Korematsu, and the opinion was handed down the exact same day as Korematsu, in December of 1944, December 18th. And in Ex Parte Indo, you had a woman who was sent to a relocation facility. She was actually a California state worker, and there was an effort in California to get all of these Japanese American state employees kind of taken off the rolls. And a lawyer found out about this and found her in the camp and contacted her and asked her if she would be sort of the lead plaintiff in a habeas petition. So she was filing a lawsuit saying that, you know, there hasn't been a suspicion of habeas corpus. Nothing in FDR's order amounted to a suspension of habeas. And when you have habeas protections, that means that the government can't take away your liberty without some sort of trial. You have to have your due process rights honored. She actually won her case. So Korematsu stands for the proposition that the government can move you around in wartime, but Ex Parte Indo said the government can't violate habeas without authorized suspension by Congress. So the actual detentions were declared unconstitutional by the court. It wasn't really a constitutional law case, though. It was more of a statutory case because they were trying to figure out what constituted a suspension of habeas corpus. But it's still interesting that the court did say you can't legally detain all of these Japanese Americans. So I guess FDR had friends on the Supreme Court because somehow he got a heads up. And on December 17th, before Ex Parte Indo and Korematsu were announced by the court on that Monday, FDR sent out a press release saying that the camps would be closed in January and all the Japanese Americans would be free. So he was able to kind of get ahead of the Supreme Court's announcement. So that was interesting. So, you know, generally the rule is that when you have even a situation involving severe national security exigencies, here we had an attack on Pearl Harbor. If you think about the comparisons with 9/11, you know, it's interesting to think about these. Even when you do have a serious national security justification, you still have to honor citizens' due process protections. And the due process clause refers to persons and not citizens. So anyone who is present in the U.S. deserves some minimal due process protections. As you know, in my section, if you read the cases for today. So anyway, the government can't do whatever it wants just because they have a national security justification. And Korematsu does not say otherwise. It's still good law, even though it's much, it's very much criticized. But it's still good law. The precedent has never been overturned.
Okay, so I'll follow this. And I want to use Korematsu to highlight two issues. And the first is what international criminal law, and specifically the law of war, which is a part of international criminal law, what that has to say about the legality of detaining civilians during wartime, whether that's ever okay. And then I'm going to also use Korematsu to make a U.S. domestic law point, and that point's going to be on status offenses, because Korematsu was before the Supreme Court because he was convicted of a status offense. So status offenses in U.S. law. I'm going to talk first about the international criminal law point and the detention point because it follows, I think, more naturally with Professor Dodd and Professor Hutchinson's talks. Very briefly, how many people think that when a nation is at war and there are people, there are states that are bent on the nation's destruction, the executive and the military should have some more latitude to act? If you agree, raise your hand. Okay, so a good number of people. Why? Why? Anybody want to say why? Articulate a rationale? Yes.
Liberty versus safety is often set up as a dichotomy. To some extent, it might be false, but to some extent, not having to go through screening at the airport. That takes more time, for example, but at the same time, you're more certain that everyone on the plane is going to be safe. These same sort of concerns can be applied across the board. If there's a legitimate threat, mm-hmm. and threat construction problems aside, if there is a legitimate enemy out there that you know intends your country ill will, then oftentimes people feel as though it's okay to give up those liberties in exchange for the added safety.
Because in reality, you're absolutely right. In reality, you know, we don't have perfection. We don't have ideals. Ideals are often in conflict. Absolutely right. Liberty, security are often in conflict. Were you going
to
add something?
Add on to, you know, a lot of these rights, they're entangled with procedural issues where you have to go back and forth and have discussions about certain things. And in some cases, when you're addressing threats, you know, an increased power to the executive can ensure that the threat is responded to more effectively.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. So international law agrees with you, both of you, on this point, right? Because international law, under the umbrella of international law, which is huge, there are two subsets. There are a lot of subsets of international law. International criminal law is one of the subsets of international law. It derives from international law. One of the major sources of international criminal law is the law of war, international humanitarian law. So I try to depict it pictorially as best I can. So they're all under the umbrella of international law. International humanitarian law is a subset of international criminal law. It's the law of war. And the idea behind international humanitarian law is exactly the point that you articulated, that, look, we have to deal in realities. And when nations are at war, in times of armed conflict, there have to be trade-offs. The executive, the state, has to be given more latitude to act under such emergency situations. But we still have to provide a minimal level of protection for those who are impacted by war. So that's the fundamental logic. International humanitarian law is a set of laws. It's a structure that tries to balance these competing ideals. And the Geneva Conventions, which you've heard a lot about in the current war on terror, the Geneva Conventions are a major backbone for modern day international humanitarian law. International humanitarian law is just another way of saying the law of war or war crimes. Now, Geneva Conventions actually were enacted after Korematsu was decided. Okay, they came after Korematsu. Korematsu is 44. Geneva Conventions is 1949. Now, the Geneva Conventions, so what's interesting about the Geneva Conventions is it explicitly contemplates that internment of civilians is sometimes legal. Sometimes it is legal for the state to intern civilians, you know, short of any sort of proof of criminal activity. Okay. Article 42 of the Geneva Conventions contemplates that in cases of absolute necessity, civilians can be interned. Article 43 says if they're interned, you have to give them, they should be released at the earliest opportunity when the reasons for internment have passed. Okay, so how does Korematsu feed back to modern day law of war? Well, interestingly, in 2001, the first war crimes tribunal since Nuremberg and Tokyo after World War II considered a war crimes case arising out of the Bosnian conflict, where the defendants who are on trial for imprisoning Bosnian Muslims out of ethnic hatred cited Korematsu in their defense as precedent, saying, look, there is a very strong precedent that what we did is lawful. And what's interesting is this tribunal, the first since Nuremberg and Tokyo, you know, analyzed Korematsu, analyzed the viability of Korematsu, and said, look, yeah, it's out there. And yeah, it's the law of the case still in the United States. But even in the United States, it has been deemed overruled in the court of history, citing, for example, the Northern District of California's granting of the writ of quorum nobis to Korematsu, citing widespread critique of the decisions. So the court refused to decline to follow Korematsu and Hirabayashi, which is another case that was very influential in Korematsu as precedent. Of course, it acknowledged. It said, yes, absolutely, the Geneva Conventions expressly contemplate internment of civilians. However, the court construed the following protections. First, it cannot be internment cannot be on a collective basis. There has to be an individualized determination of absolute necessity. It can't just be a collective guilt type thing. Moreover, being a national of an enemy, even being a national, remember Korematsu was a national of the United States, but even being a national of the enemy nation is not by itself a basis for internment, said the court. So that is kind of the most recent law on internment of civilians, sometimes possible, but with strict protections. So I'll leave it at that given the time, and I want to move to the U.S. law point that's also embedded in Korematsu, and that's on status offenses. Status offenses. So Korematsu, he was before the Supreme Court because he was convicted of a misdemeanor for violating a military order saying that he had to vacate this area and go to this assembly center. Okay, so status offenses, they can be, broadly speaking, one of two things. Okay, so one, what mode of a status offense is simply prescribing a status, criminalizing the status. So it is criminal, for example, to be addicted to narcotics, or it is criminal to be a vagrant, as we saw in Papa Christou earlier in our class. That's a classic. I mean, there's not even, what's missing there is the voluntary act of the defendant, the actus reus that we've been talking about, right? There's no conduct. There's not even an omission, right? There's not even an omission. It's just criminalizing a status. That's one mode of a status offense, and the Supreme Court has not looked very kindly on those. The Supreme Court has tended to strike those kinds of laws down. For example, it struck down a California law making it illegal to be addicted to narcotics under the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause, interestingly. However, there is another mode of criminalizing status, and this mode is very prevalent still today. And this mode is kind of what Korematsu was convicted under, which is to say, a particular conduct or omission is criminal, but only if conducted, someone of a particular class, someone with a particular identity feature. Okay, so in Korematsu's case, what he did was an omission. What was his omission?
He didn't leave.
But would he have been guilty if he was Italian or German? No. So an essential element of the crime was his Japanese ancestry. That was an essential element of his crime. That's what makes it a status offense in his case. Now, as history has progressed, as law has progressed, as equal protection doctrine has progressed, it's probably not okay anymore to criminalize so baldly status explicitly on racial grounds. However, status offenses are still alive and well today. Can you think? Just think from your experience or pop culture. What do you think might be a very prevalent form of status crimes today? Yes.
Would a status offense be if you're a convicted child abuser? To not go to your neighbor's houses and tell them that you're a child abuser?
In that sense, yes, because your prior conviction defines your status. Exactly right. But there's another one, too. Kimberly?
Curfew laws.
Did you know that in D.C., those under 17 have to observe curfew, and it's an offense if they fail to observe curfew, and it's an offense for their parents if their parents fail to control them or enable or sort of knowingly permit them to violate curfew laws. Now, that's only a crime for those under 17. So exactly right. That's a very prevalent form. Juvenile status is a very prevalent form of status offenses today. There is one other one that I want to point out because it's so prevalent, so important. What status, you know, so there's lots of identities that are not legitimate anymore to target people on, but what status tends to code with race, but it tends to code with race, but it doesn't explicitly invoke race.
Religion's
interesting. That's interesting.
The gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender?
So there were status offenses that sort of, that try to target that status in different ways by targeting certain acts or conducts prevalent, even if they may not necessarily said gay or lesbian. But there's one other one, yes.
Undocumented status.
One of the most prevalent forms of status offenses today. Offenses, penalties are being ratcheted up for undocumented status, and prosecutions, a number, are ramping up. It's one of the most prevalent forms of status crime prosecutions today. Okay, so I'll leave it with that. And I'll turn it over to Professor Figley.
One of the things you should know now is that every appellate brief should have a summary of the argument. And you have to consider what you're trying to do, audience and purpose, when you file an appellate brief. Looking at Korematsu's appellate brief, the summary of the argument is, the appellant contends that under the statute, which under he was convicted and placed on probation, is void for uncertainty and for delegating unlimited legislative power to military commanders, courts, and juries to determine what acts will be deemed criminal or punishable. He also contends that the military orders commanding his banishment from an area free from martial rule and ordering his imprisonment in a concentration camp in the absence of a crime on his part, without accusation of crime being brought against him, and the statutes, blah, blah, are repugnant to the provisions of the 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th, and 13th Amendments. In the United States brief, there is a summary of the argument. And it argues, among other things, the determination of this question involves three subsidiary questions. Whether the order was within executive order, blah, 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 and the act of March 21, 1942, upon which it rested. Two, whether the evacuation from the local region of persons of Japanese ancestry, including American citizens, was primarily designed to accomplish, was a valid exercise of the War Power Act under the circumstances. And three, if contrary to the government's contention, the question here is an issue, is whether the detention of petitioner in connection with the method adopted to accomplish his evacuation, he should have been subjected, whether that was valid. Then the summary goes on to argue the petitioner was convicted solely of remaining where he had no right to be. If this central feature of the exclusion program was valid, he cannot contend that the whole program should fail because some other part of it was invalid. He might have challenged the detention in an assembly center had he submitted to it, but if he may so challenge it, in this case we submit that the method of group evacuation and the detention was a concomitant of the method, like the exclusion itself, were reasonable and appropriate. So what the government's arguing is, all this is about is the exclusion, it's not about detention. They're saying, the court doesn't need to address whether the detention, having people in the racetrack or later on in the other facilities, was a problem. And the Supreme Court, in its opinion, pretty much goes along with the government's view that the issue before the court is whether or not is the exclusion order, which he was convicted of, is all that they're going to consider. And I think part of what's going on here is the plaintiff in the ACLU went for the home run. And by asking for so much, and they gave the government a wedge to attack something that was easier for the government to deal with. And that, I think, is what the Supreme Court dealt with and said, and may have done so for all kinds of reasons, but they were able to find a way not to deal in Korematsu with the whole detention program, but rather saying, here's a guy who knew that he had been excluded from an area, he didn't leave, he was caught, he was tried and convicted, and that's valid. One other point I think bears mentioning, and that is that the exclusion order was an executive order promulgated by President Roosevelt based upon a statute passed by Congress. And there you have both of the political branches of government in wartime deciding what's to be done. And the court, the Supreme Court, and lower courts to a lesser extent, are justifiably reluctant to wade in where both of the political branches have come to some kind of a determination. Having said that, with the 2020 hindsight that we have now from, after the turn of the millennium, we can see that this was not a good policy. But it's, I think, a little unfair to see it entirely from our perspective. The Germans had substantial success in their military campaigns in Czechoslovakia and in Norway of using civilians to do stuff. And I don't know whether the Japanese did that with the Philippines. I don't know. But I think you need to remember that it was a much different situation and a much different world in 1942 than what we are today.
So, I am in the somewhat unenviable position of wrapping up. There's a couple ways to sort of think about the Korematsu case as a property case, and I'll do that for a moment, and then I'll actually move away from it. To a great extent, the modern reader, the modern student, often approaches the Korematsu case as an obvious example of deprivation of liberty and property without due process of law. And as a case, it can sort of read that way. I can read the Fifth Amendment. It says, we will not deprive someone of their liberty or their property without due process. It says, we will not take private property for public use without just compensation. And it's possible to sort of think about what the facts are telling us in Korematsu about the people being taken away from their homes and put into internment camps solely within that sort of construct. And we can expand from that and say that's sort of a constitutional law flavor, and we could talk about the sort of incidents of ownership that are being taken away from Korematsu and those like it. They no longer have the right to use or occupy property that they previously did, whether they had it as a fee simple and they had all the sticks in the bundle, or they had it as a leasehold and they had just some of them. They no longer have a number of the rights that we would associate with property, and we can say there's something about that that should do some work for us, that should allow us to say there's a violation of his property rights and those who are similarly situated. And for those of you who subscribe to John Locke's view that property sort of begins with a property interest in ourselves, the whole liberty aspect has this fascinating concept to it that's related to what we think of as property and our ownership of it. The problem, of course, if we talk about it solely in the context of property in this rigid sort of you're in property law class, I say this all the time, I don't want to hear about torts, I don't want to hear about criminal law, right? If we do that, we lose something about the case that seems important. And in fact, I would argue that in terms of a rhetorical strategy, the majority does this as well as you could imagine. This is not about race. This is about something else. Let's talk about that something else, and let's put a lot of weight on it and not talk about or address the possibilities that there's something greater going on here. Right? Because if I told you there are times when the government has the right to exclude you from property, we could come up with scenarios where that wouldn't be terribly shocking. Your house is on fire. You have stuff inside. My Hummel figurines, you yell as you try to get back in. The police and the fire department, state actors both, could prevent you from going back into the house. Should you be able to assert a property right that allows you to sue them in some way, shape, or form, allows you to say that they have deprived you of a property right because they got in the way? Even the dissent, the first dissent in the Korematsu case says, sure, taken outside of the four corners of what's happening in these facts, we could think of ways, like the majority does, in which we would say there are exigent circumstances, there's something here that allows an action that might interfere with my property rights. But why would we do that? Why would we go to the hypothetical when we have information right here in front of us telling us this is something different? Right? We could imagine that even if we do sort of say this is about property rights and you have all the sticks in the bundle, there are plenty of things you can't do with the property. You can't have something that's wantonly dangerous. You can't have something that injures your neighbor in a way not licensed or sanctioned by law. Fine, the dissent might say. Imagine if this was a case, when you read it, in which the majority in the dissent just have this conversation about property law. What are we missing? What about the concept that when we talk about property not in this vacuum, but we talk about property in relation to race, this conversation fits in with the conversation that's happened before? That in fact, if we look in the past at Johnson v. Mintosh, which you read, property rights mean something different in the hands of those people. Right? Those American Indians don't use or occupy property in a way we deem productive. Right? And Dred Scott, you'll read, or already have read about the concept that a person who is of African descent, who is a slave, who stands before the Supreme Court and says, I assert a property interest in myself as a result of my master taking me from a place that recognized slavery to a place that doesn't, or a place that's disputable because it's a territory. And the court able to say, the Supreme Court in that case, under Justice Taney, able to say, no. In fact, you are of a status, if to go back to something Professor Fan was talking about, that doesn't require us to recognize the same property rights in you we might recognize in somebody else. Right? You can try to assert title to yourself, but beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, so far inferior they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit, bought and sold and treated as an ordinary article of merchandise and traffic wherever a profit could be made. Maybe that's too attenuated. Go to the alien land law cases that earlier in the same century as Korematsu, and hear how sort of the first generation of Japanese to arrive were told, you cannot have a right to lease, own, share crop, agricultural property. Because, among other reasons, in terms of citizenship, to some extent, the quality and allegiance of those who own and occupy farmlands are lacking in your hands. And so we do this sort of multidisciplinary approach in part to sort of illuminate the fact that when we look at cases, we can look at them through the lenses of your first year property or first year criminal law or your first year con law courses or whatever courses you might take. And we sort of recognize that the divisions between us are somewhat arbitrary. You've already seen where they bleed into each other. Right? We want you definitely to know that and to have different lenses in which to understand something. But beyond that, there are lenses outside of the confines of the first year law curriculum and lenses outside of the confines of a 3 years of law school training that you had before you came here that tell you that this doesn't seem like something that's just, that this doesn't seem like something that is fair and right, that even though we can give you this information and allow you to have the language to use in a rhetorical fashion, the language to use in terms of what to hang your hat on, and both the dissents and the majority certainly do that, but to do so in a way that recognizes that none of this is happening in a vacuum. It makes sense to hear a story, as I did just a few days ago, of somebody who was interned. Right? Who spent 3.5 years in an internment camp and was given $20 and some blankets at the end of the internment. I mean, the difficulties of thinking about what do we think of our reparations for this is in part, is there enough due process and enough just compensation that ex ante you would have said, put him away for 3 years. We'll pay you on the outside. Or is there something about the measurement of compensation that goes beyond the how much value was there in the property that was taken from you? Rich people of Japanese heritage, here's a big reparation, poor people, here's a smaller one, you just lost a leasehold. And so I just, as you think about this in terms of this multidisciplinary fashion in which it's been presented, think about it also in the context of being able to combine these in ways that bring you greater value than thinking about them through the individual subjects alone. Because I think in the end, That's how we actually face cases. That's why we talk about public policy. That's why we start to get into issues that fall outside of the four corners of a rule-based, rigid view of any particular doctrine that you're learning in this semester or any semester. That this is just a part of that journey. I have no idea what comes next, but I assume that if you have questions, we'll be available to answer.
Yeah, it was interesting when you were speaking earlier, Professor Fan, about like the international. You asked a lot of people like what they felt about, you know, liberty versus safety and things like that. And a lot of people came down on, you know, yes, they should have expanded powers, but I think it was John that said that that's a dichotomy that. But I would say that it's a false dichotomy. And I don't know if like a lot of people are from like totalitarian countries. I myself was born in Poland before the wall came down, and my parents both are from countries that had totalitarian governments. And so I say it's a false dichotomy because if you give up liberty in order to be safe from the others, you yourself have also given up safety when you become the other. Because there's like that one quote from a priest, I believe, who said, you know, they came for the communists, I wasn't a communist. They came for the Jews, I wasn't a Jew, and now they're coming for me. And so I think like that's why I think giving up safety is giving up liberty is giving up safety. And if you are from like a country that has, you know, if you take that to its logical end, you would think that a totalitarian government is a safest. And from history, we know that's not true.
That's beautifully said. I mean, beautifully, beautifully articulated. I would just press you on one point, and that's this. Does it prove that there is no trade-off, or does it prove that people can misuse the fact that there is a trade-off to go all the way down the slippery slope to the point where there you don't get any marginal benefit anymore, and in fact you are less safe? That would be the only thing I'd press you on, but beautifully said. Yes?
An entirely different topic. I was wondering, what happened to the property once everybody was rounded up, sort of.
Entrepreneurs took it.
Yeah.
And so it
wasn't held in safekeeping.
No.
It went to the state. What did you say?
Entrepreneurs, people who were able to take it and survive themselves. Yeah. Legal title.
The finder's thing?
It was a very popular program for finders. In Northern California and the white business community. So they kind of were playing up this scare, and they knew they'd benefit from it because they were getting rid of some competitors.
There's a really good movie about that, Bad Day at Black Rock, which, if you have time, is your Netflix over the summer.
Eugene.
I actually have two questions. First of all, I think, Professor Dodd, you mentioned that one of the problems, or that it's arguable whether there was any evidence of sabotage or espionage, but I was wondering, if even if they did have some evidence that there was some espionage going on, but they just couldn't pinpoint who that was, would that have provided a stronger case for rounding up a whole category, a whole class of people? So I was wondering if that would have made a significant difference, or if that doesn't really matter. And my second question is, there are ethnicity issues or racial issues. One thing that I always find fascinating is what implications does that have, like especially nowadays when you have so many multi-ethnic people. For instance, if at that time there was someone that was maybe like 1/16 Japanese, then would that still fall into that category of Japanese American? And I think that more and more we see a dilution of like one ethnicity. And I was just wondering what implications do you think such status laws have on this kind of environment?
Well, I do think that in terms of trying to figure out the degree of Japanese American involvement in espionage activities, one of the problems with that effort was that they didn't have any Japanese translators, and so
they were having a lot of difficulty and getting FBI agents to figure out accurately who was involved and who wasn't. So even when they got like high level transmissions translated, their investigative work was hampered dramatically. And that's one reason why even today during the War on Terror, people like Georgetown Law Professor David Cole have people like that have written a lot about why we shouldn't hold liberty and security as being diametrically opposed, because you need the assistance of, you know, the Arab American community in the U.S. You need the assistance in World War II of loyal Japanese Americans who are willing to assist in the effort to, you know, enlist and be translators or what have you. So to start by designating them all criminals and, you know, detaining them is not the best way to obtain much-needed assistance. And so, you know, in the days following 9/11, David Cole kept making that argument. He said this isn't the best way to do this, to round up people.
Liesl, you had your hand raised.
I do. This might be beyond the scope of what we're talking about today, but with the Geneva Convention and international, like, law of war, I think one of the cases we read in the constitutional law today talks about how it's a flexible and evolutionary thing. And it's kind of hard to see how it applies, because I think my understanding of it is that it was developed for nation states to be nation states. Mm-hmm. And today we're in this war where almost everyone we're fighting would be defined as an unlawful combatant. And so how do you go, you know, how do you go about, like, changing this law of war so that we, you know, uphold our standards of liberty, yet we're able to preserve our safety?
That's an excellent point. Do you know that unlawful combatant, by the way, it doesn't exist in international law.
Yeah,
it doesn't. It's a made-up term that we made up. But you're absolutely right that these Geneva Conventions, it's such an influential body of law that makes up international humanitarian law, first universally ratified treaty by all 194 nations of the world. You know, so enormously important. However, you're absolutely right. It's a bit dated for the nature of the conflicts that we face today. It binds, exactly as you said, state parties. It's kind of unfair in that sense because it kind of constrains state actors, but it doesn't constrain the typical entities that we are combating as terrorist entities, because they're not states and they can't contract, and it's a major problem. I think you're absolutely right. You've hit on something that, you know, I think would be a great paper topic, is a need to update. Yes.
I know it was mentioned that Korematsu has not been officially overruled at any point. Has it ever been cited, especially at a lower level than the Supreme Court, to uphold possibly questionable results? And if so, how?
The common law professor, there's a norm about Korematsu, which I think is really interesting, but the common law professors can answer that.
A norm?
The norm.
Yeah,
that,
I want to hear the norm.
My understanding was, in general, majority opinions don't like to cite Korematsu. That tends to come out in dissents or concurrences. They tend to not put it in majority. It's like a norm of writing. It's very interesting.
Well, I mean, it hasn't been overruled. There hasn't been the specific fact pattern to say, hey, to the extent that you're relying exclusively on this case, it's overruled. So, but it has been weakened as precedent in many ways. One, and most of it has been outside of the court. So many presidents. So there's this reparations movement that took years to get the results done. But as it went through, you know, the presiding president during that time would speak out in favor of it. And Congress obviously had to pass the legislation. So, you know, Congress, presidents, clearly other government officials at the state level, etc., have spoken out against the case. To the extent that the Supreme Court has done it, there's a case, there's an affirmative action case involving what level of scrutiny to apply for a particular type of remedial usage of race, and the court said even when we applied strict scrutiny in Korematsu, kind of look what happened. So the dangers are there, so we have to be really tough when we apply strict scrutiny. So the court has kind of looked at it badly, but it just hasn't had the chance to explicitly.
And it is cited all the time, but not as authority, really. There's just a great quote in one of the dissents by Robert Jackson, where there's a debate going on between Frankfurter and Jackson about whether or not the judiciary should just defer to the executive during wartime. And Jackson is generally sympathetic to the need to defer to the executive. And you know from Youngstown that especially when something like FDR's actions are supported by Congress, then, you know, it's at the highest ebb or whatever. But Jackson said, if the court ratifies actions like this, then it's entrenched. And that case and the court's opinion, he says, will be lying around like a loaded weapon. He uses this image to be launched, you know, again and again in the future. So the court should never ratify things like this. That's what he's concerned about. So that loaded weapon language has been cited often, sort of in a cautionary way. Yes.
Did anyone in the majority, like years later, ever express regret or say that they made a mistake? Just from a personal.
Yeah, I'll have to go check my Hugo Black biography. I don't know about that. I do think that immediately after in the Truman administration, I just happen to be writing about this right now, and a lot of these members in the majority were still on the court then, they were attempting to not pay reparations, but allow for property claims. The President's Committee on Civil Rights was listening to a lot of advocacy by the Japanese American community, and it turned out that, you know, they were rounded up so quickly they didn't take their deeds and their tax records and, you know, all of that material. So I know almost immediately after it happened, even before all of this hidden information was discovered in the National Archives, in the 1940s, the late 1940s, 1946, 7, 8, they were already at the highest levels of the government kind of embarrassed about what had happened to them. But I don't know about the justices.
Perhaps my question is sort of based on inaccurate knowledge. But would it have been possible for the Supreme Court to just, like, have the Korematsu decision but not publish it, and so therefore would it become precedent? Or am I making, you know, a bunch of, like, faulty assumptions?
They could have denied cert, or cert was improvident and granted. Let it go. But the ACLU and the Japanese Americans were trying to take a case up. So if this one had been turned back, then there would have been another one that came up through the system, and they have the same issue presented to them.
In the circuit courts, you can designate an opinion as unpublishable and therefore it can't be cited, but not in the Supreme Court. You just would decline cert if you didn't want to.
Yes.
Does a case like this ever bring to you the question of the system of law itself? Does a case like Korematsu bring you to question your faith in law? I mean, the Weimar Republic demonstrated that it itself used the law to persecute, you know, a race, a religion, a class of people. And then I see this parallel that happened here in America, a watered-down version. But yet again, one that parallels the very atrocities that happened just overseas, the ones that we sent one to a war to fight, protect, maybe. And here we have it here, having our own state, our own country.
Very interesting question. It really, I think, dovetails very nicely with Justice Jackson's famous dissent, which you may want to go into, about the limits of the rule of law. Justice Jackson's dissent is celebrated and perhaps not altogether correctly, because it actually shows the limits of law to constrain the military. Do you want to go into it? I can tell
you. Well, go ahead.
Justice Jackson says this is racial discrimination, there's no proof of disloyalty, it's obvious it's based on race, etc., etc., etc. Okay. But he says, in war, the military will sometimes have to do things that are not legal. And we, as a legal system, and it's going to have to happen. Okay, and it's going to have to happen. And so sometimes we just have to, as a judicial, we can't bless it, we can't have anything to do with it. We kind of just have to stand aside as a matter of necessity, which is, I mean, that's like, I think, a deep
I don't want to say it's not an indictment, but it's a deep pronouncement about the limits of law in that sense, of the limits of law.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are, you know, two different views about the role of the Constitution during wartime, which is on a PowerPoint slide for my section. You know, one is that the Constitution's not a suicide pact, you know, that's the Lincoln view. And then the other is that the Constitution's the Constitution in times of war and times of peace, that you always have to hold the executive accountable to protect constitutional rights. What Jackson was saying about the loaded weapon is that, you know, the court shouldn't ratify this policy because it is dangerous for the courts to actually ratify it. But on the other hand, he's very deferential to the arguments about military necessity. And so he says the armed services must protect the society. The armed services are not, to protect the Constitution, which is the scary, I think, part of his dissent.
So it's been called nihilist, in a sense, about the law.
I just wanted to jump in a little bit. There's... And it's one thing, and I understand it. So when I read that case and I think about it in the light most favorable to the government, which, you know, I don't give them much light, I would say, you know, if the court had grounded the ruling within military deference altogether rather than pretending to do strict scrutiny, then maybe, you know, it would be a little bit better as precedent for me. But they didn't do that. And as we relate to contemporary problems, I think the point is good that this was a statute and an executive order. But, you know, we don't have a lot of that now. And particularly on, you know, questions of war itself, Congress doesn't declare war anymore. They just pass these authorizations to use force. So some of the public reflection and debate gets missing. And, you know, if you have the executive simply doing things and then later Congress might come back and ratify it, or later the court raises a due process question, but then Congress just comes back, then it looks like everyone's just chasing each other rather than having, you know, thoughtful deliberation about where policy should go. So if you're asking me to defer to the military and that's happening, then, you know, that's a different point than simply they're just doing and we're supposed to listen.
Yeah. I think it does bring up, though, to go back to the original question even, this concept of whether the law is an instrumentality, it's a means to an end of some sort, whatever justice is, if you think it's something out there in the ether, or if you think it's something you can figure out based on a fact determination, or if it's an end, because if without those little constraints, without those laws, then, you know, we have anarchy, or we have an inability to say how things are supposed to go based on what we've seen in the past, based on precedent, something like that. But, I mean, at the very least, it makes you, if not despair of the law, or I can't remember the exact phrase you used. Lose your faith in the law so much as it makes you, I think, as Professor Fan put it, understand what the limits of the law are in terms of being able to reach a certain conclusion. Some of us who are, you know, legal realists or who are, you know, come from certain backgrounds say, this case could have been determined based on what the country felt about Japanese Americans at the time, not based on a real, true discussion of the law. This is about a disfavored racial minority. It happens to be at a time of war. The case would come out very differently if this had been Italian Americans and we were at war with Italy. Now, whether that's true or not, we don't get to find out. But certainly it makes you say, you know, this is one use of the law, but it's not certainly... I don't lose faith in the law because I don't think necessarily that the law in this particular case was what was going to work.
The way this went down was much different than the show courts they had in Nazi Germany. I mean, it really is. And we have three co-equal branches of government. And for the court to go too far in directing the other two branches what to do, leaves a huge enforcement issue. As I used to tell attorneys before we sent them off to see bad judges, remember the Marshal Service works for the executive branch. And the judge can say what he wants, but ultimately the executive branch is going to enforce it. And I think I don't think you can really compare this with what the Nazis were doing.
Thank you very much for your excellent questions and comments.